Hello, I'm Galvin.
And I'm Author Function.
And this is the Secret Boss Podcast, where we talk about the best auteurs in gaming, whether they deserve that title or not. And today, our episode is about Jay Tolan, or Jay Folan. He actually says you can say his name however you want.
Really, that is wonderful, because I have tried to pronounce it in the way he has in interviews, and I cannot do it. It's Jay Folan for me, and I won't go back.
Yeah, you know, he's been set free. He set us all free, you know? Thank you. Thank you, Jay Folan.
And that really ties into his games, because allowing for that kind of freedom, see, this is a good segue. Allowing for that kind of freedom is kind of inherent to his games. These are like open world point and click adventures where you can go around and do lots of little side adventures in your own way. There are like main quests, but you are able to sort of experiment and have a sort of casual approach to all the different problems that you're facing.
That's specifically what we're talking about today. Jay Tolan, big adventure game maker, at least, well, he's made three games and two of them are adventure games. So maybe semi-big game.
I mean, what is a shooting game, right? And if you think about it, a first-person shooter is just a really fancy point-and-click adventure.
That's true. You point and you click. Okay, let's go over what exactly Jay Tolan's deal is all about. Born 1987-ish, I have his biography here. Born around 1987, he started making games when he was a teen with Click and Play, which was this kind of like game, easy-to-make game prefab engine software made specifically for kids, but also made by a lot of game developers, even to this day. I mean, the guy who made Baba is you, he made it in Click and Play, basically. But he was, Jay Tolan, he was there in the forums around 2002 making games and releasing them on his dial-up internet, because that's all he had. Actually, Derek Yu was around there at the same time, and Jay Tolan confesses in an interview to insulting Derek Yu and saying that his game sucked around that time. And then you're like, 4 or 6 years later, Derek Yu went on and made Spelunky. So that sure showed him. She was like 12 at the time.
See, that's what I miss about the early indie game scene, is that you don't get that kind of drama anymore.
Yeah.
No. I want to see these developers fight, you know?
That's what's so fun about like TIG Source. We'll do a whole episode about them later. Okay. I'm getting ahead of ourselves. Okay. He was age 12 in 1999, which will probably come in hand later. He dropped out of high school. He never went to college. He started becoming a telemarketer after he dropped out. He hated it. He gave up on games kind of around this point. He got into prog rock, started making a lot of experimental music. This is probably where I should mention that Jay Tolan is a Christian. I think a Protestant Christian. I wasn't able to verify that. But he makes a lot of experimental Christian music. I'm not going to say gospel or worship, but it does kind of talk a lot about God and Christianity and what it means to be this kind of person. We'll get to all that later. The point is that he became a user on Something Awful, which is the worst way to start your game development career. He made a bunch of choose your own adventure threads with this character he liked named Dropsy, which was this really messed up clown who had a heart of gold despite everything. And people liked it so much that he funded it through Kickstarter. And that Kickstarter failed, so he did another one, and then that one failed, and he did a third one, and then that one succeeded, and that's what happened to become Dropsy. So let's talk about Dropsy. What do you think about Dropsy?
Well, I just want to ask real quick, how do you fail two Kickstarters and the third one works after that initial popularity? Did something happen? Do you know?
I have no idea. The first one, the first one's really funny, because it actually technically did succeed, but the stretch goal, the goal he set for it was like $200, because he was like, I just need the software and then I can just make the game. It's that easy. All the people
making the game is so easy. Oh my
exactly.
God.
$200. He was just making like click and play games and he's like, yeah, I can do a whole point and click adventure game. And then he found out that all the people who promised to do free labor for him were like, no, I actually need you to pay me. And he's like, damn it. So he came back with a second campaign like a year later. I mean, the video is really impressive. You should go see it. It opens with a guitar solo, and then it segues into a rap segment where he raps about what the game's about, and then it segues to a puppet segment where he does like a puppet show, and he does another musical where he talks about the stretch awards. Anyways, that one failed, and then the third one where he's just like, please fund my game, and then it succeeded. So to answer your long question, I don't know how he did it. I have no idea.
I also want to bring up the one bit of research I did. I looked on his website, and he says that game development is how I make my living. I often half jokingly say that my games are secretly a way to get people interested in my music. So I think that's really funny that his music seems to have had such a central role in basically like his entire career.
Yeah.
And I mean, no offense of this, because I don't know anything about music, but That was really surprising to me when I read that on his website, because a lot of the music in his games don't really stand out to me. Like, they're not the center of the game. They're nice and all, but it doesn't feel like the games are in service to the music at all.
I wouldn't say they're in service to the music, but I do think they revolve. Well, not maybe revolve, but like the music is definitely a big part of it to me. Like, I don't know. Like, one of the biggest things that stuck out to me about Hypnospace, besides the writing, which I really loved, was that there are like 7 albums in the game, just like full albums of music you can listen to. He got a bunch of different musicians, but a lot of it Tolan recorded himself. If you look at this Bandcamp, it's actually insane. It's like a Matt Farley kind of esque discography where it's like he's made like 46 albums ever since he was like 17. And like maybe 1 or 2 of them have won awards. It's interesting. Okay. Yeah.
I stand corrected. That is a lot of effort to put into your music and like a lot of space to put that in your games, I guess. The other thing that you mentioned is that these games are very Christian in nature. I can't think about these games without thinking about a lot of Christian ideals. They're not explicitly about God or Jesus or very rarely talking about Christianity in specific, but Dropsy, to start with, feels a lot like a Jesus parallel to me. Do you want to talk about what Dropsy is about?
Yes. So this is his first commercial game, Dropsy. So Dropsy is about basically, even Tolan has trouble describing it because it's kind of weird. It's about a clown who looks weird. He may or may not have a developmental disability, which is a huge, like, problematic part that Tolan just kind of keeps, like, edging around. And I think he does it pretty well in like, kind of going around it. It's definitely not too problematic. But he's a weird-looking clown to many people, and he has a big controversy behind him because 5 years before the game started, he set a circus fire ablaze that killed a bunch of people, including his own mom. So now he's kind of reviled in the community. But all Dropsy really wants to do is hug people. So he goes out with his pet dog. And I mean, this is the most important part of the game to me. There's not really an overarching objective for anything. There's not an overarching objective established until like the very end of the game. And you really, all you do is you just kind of walk around the town and try to help people, many of whom are unhappy because that's just how the world works. And if you help them sometimes, you can hug them.
I will say that like hugging as the main way of succeeding in the game felt really strange to me. There's a guy in a chicken suit very early on who doesn't want to be hugged. And this was the first character in the game who I hugged, and he did not enjoy it. He did not want to be hugged, but there was a big congratulations signs at the very end, which I thought was very strange. Like, this guy pushes you away, slams his hat on the ground in disgust, and leaves the screen, and you get this big congratulations, and Dropsy is all happy and everything. Also, I don't know if the clown's name is Dropsy or not. I never really questioned that. I just assumed that was his name. Oh, yeah. I should mention that there's no dialogue in this game. Basically, all the character interactions are done through animation or through little pictographs above their head, where you just see like little cartoon bubbles, emojis, where they're visually describing what the characters are thinking. And this is part of why people interpret Dropsy as having a developmental disorder or something, because the way that your main character is interacting with the game has a certain distance between what the characters are attempting to communicate and what information you can actually get. Because some of the puzzles in this game are puzzles because you don't really understand the motivations of characters. You're not getting the full context. You're sort of getting their emotions. You're getting their specific objectives in a way, but you're not really understanding the context that they're presenting them in. And you're not really understanding why you're doing this a lot of the time. So you're getting a very limited understanding of the characters, and you have to interact with them in a very specific way, which I think is a really interesting way of dealing with the point-and-click adventure formula, because I was thinking about it, and in defense of the idea of Dropsy as like a character developmental disorders, you sort of have 3 options when you're doing a point-and-click adventure game, because you have to like steal a bunch of stuff, you have to be willing to help people no matter what. So the ways to deal with this are not considering the narrative at all, having a main character that is sort of happy-good-lucky without really thinking about things, and get a hero who steals stuff and you don't think about it. This is a different genre. Think about how Link smashes pots everywhere, and that's not really something you're supposed to consider during the narrative. The other way of doing that is to have a sort of criminal as your main character, where it's okay to steal things and it's okay to like manipulate people and very specific objectives where it might not seem like you should be talking to these people. And then the third way in like Dropsy and also Disco Elysium and a few other games where you have a confused character who doesn't really know what they're doing and they're just sort of wandering around doing shit. And it's a sort of way of narrativizing and making a character that makes sense to why you're just doing all this random stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. In some of the talks about Dropsy, he talks about how he was kind of tired of how a bunch of games were predicated on either killing people or getting things, especially getting things with adventure games, because a lot of adventure games, he pointed out, was just kind of you walking into people's houses and taking all their stuff and then leaving. That kind of happens in Dropsy. I mean, you do pick up a lot of things, but Tolan talks a lot about making efforts to make sure that Dropsy is never seen as a bad guy or that he never has any like really malicious intents. Because to be clear, there's no like dark twist in this game. The whole thing, some people may see it as being set up to be like a don't hug me, I'm scared kind of situation where everything looks innocent, but it's actually really messed up. But the big thing at the end of this game is that no, Dropsy is really just a kind person and he really tries to help other people. And in this way, it's just kind of like, it's interesting to me because it's using the adventure game formula where it's like you take things and you trick people, usually to get your own way. But in this way, it's kind of in a way where you try to find out more about those people and try to help them so they can, that you can hug them. So in a way, it's like you're using the traditional adventure game mechanics to learn more about other people and then hug them. And I think learning more about other people is a big thing that comes up in his other games, like Hypnospace Outlaw also.
Yeah, the interpersonal relationships are a really big part of Tolan's games. I was thinking about the way that these relationships are presented in Dropsy in particular. I can't think about almost any element of this game without thinking about the Christian element, because the way that you help people in Dropsy reminds me a lot of a lot of Christian teachings. And it's also a very interpersonal way of thinking about things where you're just thinking about the person and their needs. And you're also thinking about empathy and giving them as much kindness as possible without thinking about any broader systemic issues. Like, for example, there is a homeless character in the game and you can do a lot of really nice things with the homeless character. You can give the homeless character food. You can give them hugs, just small moments of support, which are really important and really helpful for a lot of homeless people. And the way of sort of resolving this conflict is through going to the, having the church recognize that, oh my God, there's a homeless person over there that needs help. Instead of spending all the time spreading a bunch of like hate for rock music or whatever, we should be helping homeless people instead. And like I said, that's really important. But it's also a very localized understanding of the issue, only thinking about it in an interpersonal way instead of like systemic ways that we can help homeless people instead of how can we personally help a homeless person. But it is a very Christian understanding of solving this topic, and it specifically presents the church as the way of solving this issue. I don't know if you have any other thoughts about this, Galvin, but I have a few more Christian thoughts about this game.
I guess to me, I was thinking of that as a systemic kind of overhaul, because to me, like beforehand is interesting to me because it's like the woman in the church or the priest or whatever is preaching to these homeless people. She wants to help them, but she's like helping them by giving them food and then preaching to them about God while they're in there. And that's what a lot of like evangelists, maybe not evangelists is the right word, but like that's what a lot of Christian organizations do, in that they kind of, in real life, and they kind of like give food to people, but then you have to listen to them lecture to you about, you know, Christ or whatever. And to me, I don't know, Dropsy opening that window and showing her that, hey, you can try and do like more legitimate things to help out the homeless is actually more of a systemic overhaul of the church than capitulating to like the systems below it. I know it's like on a local scale, but like the game never really goes to a global scale at all. It only takes place in this town. Personally, that's just me taking the church as a whole and like extrapolating it to all churches, but I think it is a systemic overhaul.
Well, I certainly agree that it can be read that way, but I think that there's a general trend throughout the entire game. Like, because of Dropsy's specific way of looking at the world, he wants to be kind to people, and through that kindness, things will be fixed. But it provides a certain way of doing things that I can't help but think outside of a Christian context where a person should be fixing themselves instead of thinking about anything else. Like, to give another example, there are a few different characters in the game who have substance abuse problems, where they're, or not substance abuse. There are characters who have desires like everyone else, except their desires are alcohol or weed. The way that you resolve these needs and desires, one of them is to give them a rose as an act of kindness. One of them is to have a character meet a girl that they like. Another one is to listen to a good song. And these are the three that I remember. But like, the understanding of fixing these substance desires is to distract yourself and change your viewpoint where you're thinking about something else instead of, for example, like having dedicated rehab services, or like maybe there could have been a doctor that they could go to. I don't know. It felt like another individualist way of thinking about these problems.
I didn't think of it like that, but I didn't really connect like the substance abuse thing to like being given a rose. But when you put it like that, yeah, I can see it. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, in general, I do think there is this Christian tendency to be like, I don't know how to really put it, but I guess it's like simpler solutions for maybe possibly more complex issues. Yeah, like not addressing the systemic problems behind things. I think, I mean, okay, I'm going really broad here. In general, I think left-wing groups tend to see more the problems of the world in more systemic ways, while the right-wing groups, which a lot of Christian groups fall into, see a lot of the problems in the world as related to moral problems. So I would say Dropsy falls more into that kind of right area, not in the way that it's like completely disregarding systemic issues, because really Dropsy isn't about fixing the world. It's mainly about this guy who wants to hug people. So it never really goes for the big swing like that. But I do agree with you that a lot of the problems in this game are mainly solved through like moral things like kindness, or like, you know, can't we just all get along, that kind of thing. I do think I want to bring up one counterexample, though, because this was the one that really shocked me. Minor spoilers. This happens maybe like an hour or half an hour into the game. It's kind of set up as an overarching thing where Dropsy's dad gets sick, basically. He gets sick, he falls ill to some disease, and he has to get bedridden, basically. And he needs medicine, you know, some kind of medicine. But you guys don't have healthcare insurance, your family, basically. So you go to the hospital and they say, well, you don't have insurance. You can't really get in. Again, here's a spoiler to a puzzle if you want to see it. The solution is not ever to go to the hospital. The hospital is a dead end. You actually have to sneak into a pharmacy and hijack the security system by turning the robots into like cocktail robots or whatever. And in that way, you can take the medicine and come out. So in that way, the game is actually addressing a systemic issue with the world, in that it's saying, hey, look, the medical industry right now, the healthcare industry, is not working. It doesn't help people in the way that Christians are supposed to help people, or in like secular people want it to help anyone. So in this way, you can actually do what at least Tolan thinks seems to be the right thing, because Dropsy is never depicted as a really bad person, by taking this medicine and giving it to your grandfather. And I would argue there are other versions, there are other ways of criticizing the church in multiple ways of this game, where he's talking about like how the church doesn't really help homeless people, because it's like they're too focused on promoting their agenda to like really address issues with them, like the puzzle you mentioned before, or how Christians aren't really tapped into the outside secular world. We can talk more about that in the Hypnospace Outlaw section, because that's also mentioned there. But those are just a few examples off the top of my head.
Yeah, yeah. I do want to clarify that I don't think this game is like immoral or hashtag problematic or anything. I think that this game is presenting a specific view of the world, which I don't think is entirely accurate, but I think it's very admirable, and I think this is a game that could be very useful for a lot of people about like just sharing kindness with your community and having that sort of community building effort. I'll have a problem with Christianity. I'll have a problem with this aspect of Christianity. I think it's a very kind and thoughtful way of encouraging a lot of help towards the needy and everything. I just think that that is not a entirely productive way of thinking about this for a larger scale, which a lot of people just sort of stop there at the kindness and everything, where we should be doing more than that. And I think I resonate a lot more with art that helps to communicate the importance
of
going even beyond kindness.
I agree. Plus, the game has a day and night system, which changes how you can, which makes you have to like walk back and forth between screens to solve puzzles. So it's actually really like a 1 out of 10. Yeah. So it's terrible. All right. Let's talk about Hypnospace Outlaw next.
Okay. I have some spoilery thoughts on Dropsy that I think we're going to get to at the end. We're going to do spoilers for these two games at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to put a pin on that there are a lot more Christian themes that I want to talk about.
Okay. All right. Hypnospace Outlaw. Can you describe this game for us, Offer?
Yeah, so Hypnospace Outlaw is a game about being an internet moderator in the late 90s. I think like literally 1999 for this special high-tech social media outlet where I think that the sci-fi context is that this is a computer that you use while you're asleep, when you're dreaming. It doesn't really come up in any meaningful way, I personally think. But you're basically visiting a bunch of web pages in the same way that you would visit a bunch of web pages on your computer. There are windows, there are apps, there's executables, there are scripts. Everything that you can really think of on a computer is simulated throughout this fake game space. And there's a separation between the curated game space, social media aspect, where the company is showing you a bunch of different web pages, and the more like viruses and underground aspects of the game. And your job as an internet moderator is to get rid of the aspects that are against the policies of the company in question, where you're supposed to get rid of, say, copyright infringement, harassment, illegal stuff. And that's really your role. It's just scroll through a bunch of these web pages and perform your internet moderator duties. And these range from really small stuff, like the copyright infringement. There's a really funny, runny bit where there's a goldfish mascot who I don't remember the name of, that you're supposed to be copyright striking throughout the game. And people are really mad that you keep on copyright striking this one fish for no reason, because who fucking cares that they're using this fish mascot and their web pages.
It's about freedom of speech. Yeah. Freedom of speech for the people.
And then they can range from like a bunch of sexual harassment that the users are going through that you don't really have a good way of solving without getting the person who's getting sexually harassed getting in trouble, which I think is a really good critique about the way computerized systems aren't necessarily fair, even if rules apply to everyone in theory. Hypnospace Outlaw is a very different kind of game while still being the same. It's still like an open world kind of feeling, and there are a lot of like very funny dialogue, and it really gives a really genuine feeling 90s web page. What are some of your favorites? I can't think of any on the top of my head.
My favorite page is probably the Vain Rocks 14, which is this teenager. You get a message that's like, hey, check this guy out. He's like harassing other people. You click on his page and you're instantly blasted with like the most Linkin Park song you've ever heard. Like there's like rotating guns and like skulls and like a text in the middle that's like says sexy both on and offline. It's great. It's
beautiful. A comic where he complains about his mom.
Yeah. And then you click on another teen's page and there's like a whole bit about how much he hates that first teenager, Zane. And he's made a whole badge where it's like his face is getting punched in. And he's like, share this badge if you think Zane sucks. And you can report that guy for harassment also.
Yeah, it really gets that fun aspect. I wouldn't say fun, that interesting aspect of the internet where lots of small, petty stuff with kids are happening in the same space of professional websites. And all these places are both of the same thing while still being in conflict in a lot of emotionally totally dissonant ways. Honestly, a lot of this game I thought I had the most fun of in the side stories and not really thinking about the main plot.
No, I really agree with that, because like I think this is where Hypnospace succeeds, where I think Dropsy kind of doesn't succeed. I like Dropsy, but I probably wouldn't recommend it to anyone, to be clear. That's where I'm at right now with that game. But Hypnospace I would recommend to anybody, because I feel like Dropsy was set up as a game where it's like, yes, there is an overarching plot with an ending eventually that you get to, but most of the game really is just wandering around this town and not really knowing what to do. And sometimes you meet people and you can learn about their lives by looking around. And that's the juice of the game, getting to know other people through the adventure game mechanic. And that's applied to this game in a way where it's like, oh, you're reading these people's web pages. And this game has really, really good writing when it comes to like showing how people talk on the internet to kind of like create a persona for themselves and hide like their true self from people. This game has a really good way of like, this game, I think Jay Fallon's way of writing is a lot better with text than without text. He really has a good handle on how people type here. And yeah, that's what the side stories are really about. You get to read people's stuff and nearly all of it is fun. I didn't regret reading anybody's stuff. I was never bored, like unlike the real internet. And you can technically blaze through the whole game just doing the cases that the company assigns you. But I think the game even does a very good, clever way of setting this up at the very beginning by showing that your job as an enforcer or a moderator or whatever is ultimately very stupid and goes against the principles of the internet as a democratic society where people can talk to each other. All the people having the most fun, the most interesting people are the ones, the normal people who use the internet. And your job, your very job, you actually are introduced to this very early. There's a whole messaging application you can't go on because you're a moderator. You can never go on there. Everyone's talking on there. Everyone's talking to each other. But you can only ever see like screenshots and things because you're a moderator and you can't interact. So the system that you're being framed in that pushes you into the game is a system that you ultimately fight against. And by the end of the game, the system doesn't matter. It's only the people remaining that matter.
Yeah, the points of friction that I had with Drop C aren't really here. I think that J.T. Holling, I think is how I'm going to pronounce it now. Tholen's really individualist, empathetic stance where he's thinking about these characters and how much that we should be caring about them and thinking about them and seeing them as their own holistic person with their own needs and wants. I think that works a lot better here when you can actually see what they're like beyond a surface level, showing how they want to present themselves. I think that really stands apart in this game, especially because you're seeing how people are thinking about who they are and trying to become a whole person while they're still under the whole system that surrounds it. Like they're being restricted in certain ways by you, the player, or by their ability to do things on the app. Like I mentioned, the person who was sexually harassed in the game, this is something that matters to them, but all they can do is really post on their page and hope that someone sees it and helps. They don't really have a lot of options there. And other people are doing random stuff like hacking the web interface. They're installing viruses for people. There's a really funny and annoying thing where I think it's called like Mr. Professor, which technically isn't a virus. it's like a Clippy character that you could install onto your machine and will annoy you occasionally, way too often. Offering to help, and you can't do anything to get rid of it. You can't do anything to report the person who made it for making this thing that is worse than most of the viruses that you experience, because it's considered legitimate. It is institutionalized in a way that you can't really deal with. And I thought that's like a really funny running gag and also a very potent satire.
I think another part of this is it shows the game is also a lot about how people fight back against this kind of thing. I think one particular example is there's this kind of side story that leans into the main story about five different like sci-fi or like nerdy different communities that all get merged into one without their consent. Basically, it becomes like this thing called like the Starport community, because each of the sites are split up into like vague categories, and there used to be five different categories, but now they're all merged into one. And there is also like an old format called NetSettler, which is being deprecated. And people who are using that kind of old type of website aren't able to bring it over to the new Hypnospace now. So instead of going through with all that, they decide to defect from the main community and establish their own community called the Freelance, which has this really annoying like world map kind of structure where you walk around the different screens to kind of make it harder to take down. So that's one way of people fighting back. Another way is like through archival efforts, which kind of mirror real life archival efforts like internetarchive.org with all the lawsuits they've been going through right now, or how Adobe Flash Player got taken down because people are trying to preserve it with Flashpoint. That comes in handy a lot later in the later parts of the game. By the end of the game, it's a lot about how people fight back against the systems that are imprisoning them. And even outside of that, it's just about how people used to have these systems of communication where they can talk very easily to each other. And that kind of gets taken away. Vague spoilers, there's kind of an allusion to like Web 2.0 encroaching at the very end of the game. And I think that's very poignant when it comes to like showing how things would be much different coming over into the new century.
Yeah, I think the way that this game is dealing with the past and dealing with thinking about the 90s, it feels unique in a lot of visual spaces. People are often either heavily parodying the old internet when they do so, or they're sort of making fun of how things used to be, or they're overly nostalgic for a better area where you could do whatever you wanted. Whereas this game attempts to show like both the good and the bad. It's showing a lot of ways that people used to express themselves on the internet that isn't possible now in a lot of ways. And it's also showing how a lot of the problems that existed back then were either worse or have still not really been dealt with in any meaningful way. Because while a lot has changed, a lot hasn't changed. And being able to recognize both of those aspects is really thoughtful and worth thinking about in nostalgic work.
Yeah. I actually wanted to share something that interesting that happened with me to this game. Because like, I mean, going into Hypnospace Outlaw, I feel like a lot of people take the 90s internet thing as a huge aspect of the game. Personally, I don't think so, because I was never familiar with the 90s internet. I'm younger than Offer, to be clear, and I didn't grow up in that era, and I don't know much about it.
I didn't either.
Okay.
My experience with the 90s internet is the Space Jam website gets linked every once in a while. Showing, wasn't the 90s websites weird? I think that's
the one you check. I assume you were born in like 1851 or something. I never really asked you when you were born.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but like I was never really familiar with 90s internet and things like that. So going into it, I was expecting it to be this kind of nostalgia overload for people who, and like I would be an outsider who didn't get it. But I related to a lot of the things that were presented in the internet as things that related to like my perception of the internet through Web 2.0 and Twitter and Facebook and all that kind of thing. To the point where I even thought like at some point, I thought the game was like really naive at some points with its writing. I had this prejudice going into the game where it was like a Christian writing the vile internet. And I thought it would be taken in a kind of like naive way, or kind of, you know, you don't understand how bad things really are on the internet kind of way. And the first time I played this game, when I put it down, maybe I was like a quarter of the way through or halfway through, I opened up Twitter immediately after and I saw people typing the same way. It's weird to me because it's like the sentiments are the same. Like it's not really 90s internet at all. There are a bunch of things carried over, as a matter of fact, from the modern world to this game. There's a whole parody of Vaporwave in this 90s internet game, which doesn't make sense at all timeline-wise, but it works as a commentary on the internet in general. But like looking at people on Twitter, I was like, wow, this... the internet really hasn't changed and people really are still hiding behind things. I think there's a tendency for people, me, to go on the internet in the modern day and look at a bunch of cynical people on 4chan or Twitter and be like, this is completely messed up. You know, we're never going to go back to the way things were. These people are like beyond like communication with how things used to be, you know, but things are the same, or things are similar at the very least. It's not that people don't change. Times do change people. I think that's true. But there is a kind of human nature, I think, that's captured in this game that is vast across multiple different decades. And I think that's the real heart of this game, to be able to close the 90s internet, this thick 90s internet, and go on the internet and see people are communicating in the same way. So to me, it's not really a 90s internet simulator, although I'm sure to other people it is.
Yeah. I think that we should get into spoilers because I haven't mentioned any Christianity yet. I can't talk about the Christianity okay. In this game until we get into spoilers.
It's been bubbling up in your chest like bile ready to come up.
Yeah, I need to wash my hands of this.
To be clear, neither of us are Christian, I'm pretty sure. I feel like we should have mentioned that earlier in the podcast. I'm sure you figured it out by this point. Yeah.
So getting into spoilers for this game, I think... what I'm thinking about is the way that the villain comes into being. So what happens in this game is Y2K, there is a great big problem where a bunch of people die. There's a virus that's infecting the Hypnospace area where anyone who's online during that time dies from a bunch of problems. You know, sci-fi, you're wearing this big sci-fi helmet thing. You're going to die if you're wearing it.
To be clear, it's only a few people who die. A bunch of other people were online and they got seriously injured. But there's a pattern, if you notice throughout, that a lot of people who die are very weak at the time. There's like a person who's staying up all night trying to code and edit to a website that he's making. There's other people who are very old. But yeah, a lot of people die. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't catch that. But the way that the game ends up going is that the person who caused this to happen was one of the programmers who was basically in charge of the development of Hypnospace, where, and someone else takes the fall. Someone who was doing a sort of harmless little prank on the website ends up getting in trouble for it and going to prison for it. And the person who actually committed the crime gets off scot-free. And the way that this ends up going is that you try to get all the evidence to take this villain down, take down whoever did this. And as you get closer and closer, this person gets madder and madder. And they're like, hey, you should probably stop doing that. They start threatening you and everything. But once you get all the evidence, the villain comes out and goes like, you know, you caught me. I feel really bad about it. They sort of like completely change on a dime. You get kind of like an anticlimax, where instead of you're taking down the bad guy, you're sort of recognizing that person as someone who made mistakes. And now that they can't get out of it anymore, they have to reckon with the idea that they did the shitty thing and they have to go to people and apologize and ask for their forgiveness. And they try to ask for forgiveness by creating their own video game where a bunch of people that died on that night are represented through little vehicles in the game. And when you capture these vehicles, you get a little message that says, "User X ascended to heaven," I believe is the quote. And it's floating into the air and is like a representation of paradise. Yeah, it's a very Christian way of thinking, because like this villain has realized what they've done, and they're trying to absolve themselves of their sins by confessing and trying to apologize and recognize the harm that they've done. I have some confusing thoughts on this. I think it's a lot more nuanced than my criticisms of Dropsy. It doesn't represent the real world in a way that I think is useful or meaningful. But I also think that it is important and useful aspect of Christianity, where instead of morality being something that accumulates, like think about a lot of morality in video game systems. You're playing Mass Effect, for example. If you're playing the good route, the more good things you do, the better person you are. The more bad things you do, the worse of a person you are. And you are defined as a person, as a character, by how much good or bad that you do. Whereas with Christianity, if you do a lot of bad things, but if you try to change things and try to become a better person, then you can be forgiven for the sins that you've committed. And that's not really something that you see in a lot of video games. A lot of video games have very black and white morality. And even if there is like more layers of morality, there's still that idea of accumulation for all the things that you've done. And funny enough, the only counterexample I can think of is Undertale, where you can fuck up a lot, kill a lot of people, and you can still end up being okay in the end. Yeah, it's not really a theme that you see in a lot of video games, where you can be forgiven for the bad things that you've done.
So to be clear, Offer, you're saying that you think this engineer who was caught, he's atoning for himself. And by making this game, and they're ascending to heaven. Like he's trying to become a good Christian by doing this.
Not necessarily like a good Christian, but aligning with a lot of Christian ideals of becoming a better person.
I just want to say that I almost completely disagree with that. Yeah.
Interesting.
This is something that makes me kind of irritated. Well, this is... No, I'm not going to say that. That's too far. But I think a lot of people misinterpret the ending in a way that I think is completely misaligned with what the game is trying to say. Because this person, to be clear, this engineer you see throughout the game, he's never portrayed himself as a Christian. He's never shown himself to be a Christian in any way. And as a matter of fact, he seems to be like a more kind of fun, kind of tech bro-y kind of person in a way that aligns with a lot more like atheist ideals in a way. Not saying he's an atheist, but it kind of feels like that. And yes, he does make this game at the very end where the thing that causes this huge thing that kills a bunch of people is this engineer's car game, which is so bad that it breaks the system, basically. He's been trying to make this car game in preparation for the Y2K update, and he rushes it, and as a result, that kills a lot of people. You cut to like however many years later, when you finally catch this guy, he makes this game to atone for his sins and apologize, or so he says, and it's a remake of his car game. His car game he made that killed a bunch of people. And you play it, and you see all these people from the past in 1999, styled after their avatars in 1999, those people who never got to grow up. You see, at some point, you can let a 14-year-old die, and you get to see his car blaze with the kind of like trails of his 14-year-old website, even though he's been dead for like 25 years or whatever. And he ascends into heaven by you saving him. And then every time you ascend, every time you send this person to heaven, you get this message in your document that after the credits you can read. And let me just read through some of these messages. One of the people who dies is this kind of engineer who was working for this company, and he was forced to pull an all-nighter working on the Y2K mine crash. And because of that, his brain got really weak and he got killed by it. And this engineer says, "You were actually the closest one to me because you were supporting me and helping me build my masterpiece while everyone else was against me." Again, deflecting it back to him. There's another person who he's like this boomer who runs this anti-government page, and he dies because he's kind of frail and old. And the engineer says, "Your family actually came to me after you died, and they disgusted me. They smelled like body odor. Their clothes were stained, stretched out, and dirty. They wore flip-flops. And I want you to know that if they're still around, I'm going to make it right. I'm sorry." That's his message. That's his message. That's the eulogy to the person that he's writing to. There's another person, a senior citizen, who spends the entire game trying to figure out how to make a website. She finally makes one through the help of her friends. And she stays for Y2K. And then it kills her. And this engineer's message to her is, "I'm sorry." Two words. That's it. The 14-year-old, "You could have become someone your mother was proud of. I'm sorry, Zane." Not accepting this person for who he is. Just kind of being like, "Well, you could have been a good person, but you weren't. I'm sorry. I didn't like you, but it's sad that you died, you know?" I think this entire game, even though some people see it as bittersweet, I really do think by the end of it, it's actually a very bitter ending. You confront this tech bro, this person who set up this whole beautiful world where people can interact with each other. And when you finally get to him, instead of empathizing with him, as you do with many of the citizens who you meet, he does this kind of pathetic impression of what he believes empathy is like. And the tragedy is at the very end, this person who built this entire empire in front of you, he can't even see the people who he helped, who he built this platform for as people. He can't see it. And he's just kind of stuck in this kind of like tech bro-y adolescence forever, asking for a fake kind of forgiveness as a kind of sleight of hand. And that's his last trick. And then the game ends. That's the way I see it, at least.
Okay. Yeah, that's a reading I definitely respect.
I think part of the ending in the way it's designed is that, first off, it's obvious the fact that there are no responses after his confession means that it's up to you to decide whether you, as a player, forgive him or not. I think that's the main reason that was set up like that. But another thing is, I feel like some people will see this guy, this person apologizing, as very sincere, as genuinely giving himself up. And other people will see this guy who's trying to ask for forgiveness as very insincere. Maybe it goes either way. Personally, I think it was written with the deliberate intent to be insincere. But the point is that if you see this person as insincere and you still forgive him, then that's fully taking in Tolan's like Christian mindset, I think. If you see this person, even horrible as he is, still being horrible, even after he's been caught, after 20 years of evading law, and you still forgive him, then the game succeeded, or Tolan succeeded in what he's wanted to say. At least that's the way I see it. So I think it is ambiguous in how you see it, but it's mainly about your response as a player that matters more.
I think that thinking about Tolan as an auteur in this way is really, really enlightening for the way that we're reading this text, because mm-hmm. we can think about Christianity in a lot of different ways. We can think about the idea of a Christian game developer and presenting those ideas in completely different ways. And there's a lot of room for interpretation here, both as the game itself, as a text, and thinking about the author as a text.
I do think this is a rare thing, because even Tolan has pointed this out. A lot of Christian artists, they cater to Christians. So in that they make art specifically for Christians to get them to closer embrace their kind of like Christianity. And they kind of reject the idea or push back on the idea of engaging with more worldly or secular people. Tolan has talked a lot about how he wants to make art for secular and Christian people, in that he wants to engage with the themes of Christianity with everybody in a way that doesn't explicitly, in a way where you can play the game and not be like, okay, this guy has to be a Christian if you don't know about it, you know. He says this thing in an interview that I think sticks out to me, where he's like, wouldn't it be wonderful to live in a world where people can see a game that doesn't mention Christianity, but is kind and is about forgiveness, and think, hey, that might be a game made by Christians, because that's the ideals, those are the ideals they're trying to push as a religion. To not even connect it to the teachings of Christ or going to heaven or hell or all the details within the religion of Christianity, but just the general idea of kindness and forgiveness. If you can associate that with Christianity instead of whatever it's being associated with now, it would be wonderful. At least those are his words. I'm paraphrasing. But yeah, I think that ties into what the games are about.
Yeah, as a side note, I find it interesting how a lot of great art from the past 2,000 years of Christian artists looks completely different from a lot of the Christian institutions that are making media nowadays. Like, yes. if you think of like great movies like Passion of Joan of Arc or Dead or something, and you look at older stories like The Green Knight or something that have a lot of Christian themes, they feel a lot different than something like God's Not Dead or something. And Tolan feels a lot more like the former than the latter.
Now you have God's Not Dead. Okay, well, that's fair, you know, bad. But consider this. God's Not Dead 2.
God's Not Dead 3. I mean, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's when it really starts getting good, you know?
It's all right. I don't have a lot to say, spoiler-wise, about Dropsy. But I do want to mention that Dropsy is literally Jesus in that game. He dies and then... he is killed by his brother, betrays him, and yeah. He ascends to heaven or like a paradise. And
yeah,
I don't have a lot of like deep thoughts about this besides it being a Jesus there parallel, but I think it's a very funny parallel.
It's pretty obvious. Yeah. It's funny to me that it's like, oh, Jesus is a clown and he gets shot, but then he goes to heaven, but heaven is a spaceship and he gets to hug his mom.
Yeah.
It's such a weird, it's such a strange way to put it, but, you know, I think it's good.
Despite all the other Christian themes in that game, I have no deeper thoughts about the ending. I just think it's funny.
Yeah, it's a very funny ending. I didn't do many of the side quests, so it kind of hit me like a truck when it came up. It turns out there's a lot of foreshadowing if you do the side quests, but I didn't, so it was like, what? He gets teleported to space? That's the ending of the game?
Did you at least learn that he was an alien before that ending happened?
I mean, his dad takes you to like the shed and shows you the spaceship. So that is part of it. But like, there were a bunch of other clues that I found out after I beat the game. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about, this is a doozy. You didn't play this game. This is his third game that he worked on. His most recent game as of now. He's currently working on a sequel to Hitler Space Outlaw called Dream Settler, which is not really a sequel. It technically takes place afterwards, but it's meant to be a standalone game. But right now, his most recent game is a spinoff of Hitler Space Outlaw called Slayer's X Terminal Aftermath Vengeance of the Slayer. And it's not Vengeance, it's called Vengeance. It's misspelled on purpose. So remember our funny man, Zane Rocks 14 from earlier in the game? Well, this game takes place in the world where he grew up to be 35 and he finishes a Doom mod that he started when he was 14. So it's actually a first-person shooter that's styled like a bunch of Doom games, boomer shooters actually, and it's extremely edgy. There's Linkin Park blasting throughout all of it. There's you fight a bunch of like poopy turds from a toilet. Everything, there's like fart sounds everywhere. Zane himself is commenting over it like, oh, I better shove a turd up these guys' bungholes. There's just like a bunch of garbage rock music playing over the whole thing. And this game is really interesting to me because it almost feels like a repudiation to everything we just talked about. This one is really,
I was not expecting that lore. That sounds wonderful. And to be clear, it's Linkin Park styled music, right?
It's not actually Linkin Park. Okay. Yeah. Very well done music, by the way. It sounds very good for what it's trying to pastiche, you know?
Yeah, I have nothing to say about that, but it sounds wonderful. And I assume that there isn't a lot more to it than that? Or
no, I'm going to talk more about it. There is more to it. Okay. Because to me, the way I see this, Glöckling for all lines, like auteur land, you know, it's like he's challenging himself, you know? Like, he made these two games about where you are mostly kind people. Sure, one of them you're a cop, but like, you get to empathize with other people. And by talking to outside people, by connecting with them. And now he's like, okay, let me make a game that's entirely localized within one person's mind. The coolest guy's mind possible. He's 35 years old. He still listens to Linkin Park. He's a man-child who lives in his mom's house, basically. And all he wants to talk about is, you know, shooting guys in the butthole and, like, punching poopy guys in the face and, like, saying swears and stuff like that, you know? So it's set up like that, and you're like, okay, initially this is a cruel joke. Like a lot of jokes in Hypnospace, you look at the page, you look at a lot of people's pages initially in Hypnospace, and you're like, okay, the goal is to laugh at these people. They're very silly. Some of them are pretty stupid. Some of them don't know how to use technology. It's kind of, you know, a cruel joke initially, but the more you get into it, the more you see, you look at their pages, the more you realize, the more you learn about them. It's like going backstage and looking at a person after they finish performing. You know, you get to see the persona behind it. And that's what I think Tolan is challenging you to see in this game, because there are things in this game, actually, as a matter of fact, that are empathetic, but he doesn't shove them into your face. You can genuinely beat the entire game and not run into like any of the empathetic threads that he sets up for you. The ending is completely done sincerely from the edgy guy's perspective. You kill everyone in the game. You become the coolest guy in the world. There's no like irony to it or anything. But if you look closely at the parts, if you look closer at the parts of the game, there are things there. For example, there's this whole meta aspect to it where there is a Twitter account made to promote the game, and Zane gets on there and he talks a lot about his life and stuff like that. He's working now as the manager of a Dollar Tree, which you get to see in the game. His manager used to go out with his mom, and he's really pissed off about that. He's so pissed off about that that the manager of the Dollar Tree, the previous manager of the Dollar Tree, is the main villain of the game. He's actually manufacturing all the demons, and you kill him at the end. The thing that starts off the whole game is that his mom gets killed. His mom is still alive in real life, but I think it's touching that his mom being killed is like the one thing that sets him off to kill everybody. You see a bunch of like fake ads throughout the game, because even in this fake world, he can't use real copyrighted material. So it's like one letter removed from the one letter removed copyrighted properties. But you see a lot of properties like pay up phone services, you know, him complaining about the phone bill. You get to see him complaining about like traffic or like a bunch of annoying people at the dollar store that he works at. One especially insane part is when you find out throughout the Twitter that he actually has a son. The partner he had his son with left him, so he's just like a single dad now. And if you pay attention to the game, you realize that he's actually making this extremely profane game kid-friendly for his kid. There's a middle finger button, which you can hold down. And if you look closely, you realize it's actually his ring finger that he's flipping up. All the swears are censored, so he never actually swears in the game. There's little to no blood throughout the entire game. So he's made this extremely edgy from his 14-year-old self for his kid, and he's made it kid-friendly. And you can find secret areas where he's hidden his kids' drawings, and he like legitimately talks about how much he loves them in there. I mean, there's just all a bunch of this stuff like hidden if you look for it. And it's all there. And a bunch of like really dark stuff too. You'll find a hidden enemy in the game that is just a fetus, a demon fetus. I mean, there's a whole lot to unpack there. It's never brought up by him. There's a secret area which you can fall down in the game, which is, okay, now we're getting into spoiler territory. There's this secret area you can fall down in the game, down a pit, where if you fall down, you'll actually find a hidden message hidden by the game's programmer. Because Zane didn't program this game. He got his childhood friend, who promised he'd finish the mod when he was 14. He got him back at 35 and forced him to finish the mod. So you see a message from the programmer there being like, what is this guy doing? You know, what is this guy doing with this game? He's 35. He has a kid. He thinks his ticket out of him being a manager at this Dollar Tree is this video game. It's so sad, and I don't know what to do anymore. Here's a picture of him. Laugh at his stupid fucking face. And it's like crushing, you know? This whole game is predicated in sadness of just from the fact of it being a 35-year-old making his 14-year-old, you know, original idea for Doom mod, obviously. But this game, like, invites a kind of pathos through it, not by, like, shoving it in your face or, like, in a way where you have to see it in front of you. You can really take all the things of this guy being, like, a sad man-child and laugh at him even harder if you want. The invitation is up there for you. But it's up to you if you want to forgive him or not, or not forgive him, but, like, empathize with him or not. And that's really interesting for me. It feels like a challenge set up for Jay Tolan to make this kind of game, not giving this guy too much empathetic leeway, but also not forcing the viewer to be like, okay, I empathize with you, you know? The viewer could push all this away at any moment and just paint it as another boomer shooter.
I just want to say I knew nothing about this game and I had zero interest, but you have completely sold me on this game. I really want to check it out.
Okay. Yeah, it's really interesting because I feel like there's a progression over his career, you know? Dropsy is, I think, the most naive out of the three of these games in that it's like the most one-sided. I mean, it still has multiple dimensions compared to like God's Not Dead, but like when it comes to being kind, you know, it's a good thing to promote. There's some nuance to it, like we need to address some systemic issues sometimes. Hypnospace Outlaw, the systemic issues are more prevalent. It introduces to me the most important part, which is cynicism of modern people, even Christian people, and like how that affects how people think, you know, and people's attempt and Tolan's attempt to be like optimistic and a kind Christian throughout it, basically. And now you have Slayer's X, which is fully throwing down the gauntlet. Again, I think he made this with the expectation that people won't have played this game without having played Hypnospace first. So there is that expectation set up there and being able to empathize with these people and then playing this game and being like, okay, I'm throwing down this gauntlet to you. Here's this sad man who hates everything and he wants to kill everybody. And he just keeps talking about poop and farts and shoving things up people's butts. And I want you to empathize with this person. And I'm not going to give you any help. So I can only imagine where he's going to go from here. I don't know. I think he's improving a lot.
I completely agree. There's a really interesting progression here in both like themes and development and structure. And I'm really excited to see what he does next because I'd say that there's a big leap in nuance and complexity.
I agree. Any recommendations? Are we done with the episode? I don't know if I have more to talk about.
Yeah. Recommendations. I would personally recommend Hypnospace Outlaw. I think it's most unique game from based on what I've seen. It feels both complex and a lot of fun. A lot of funny bits, a lot of sad bits. It's the internet of everything. You got everything there. What do you think?
Yeah, I would also definitely recommend Hypnospace Outlaw. To be clear, I want to make it clear how much I liked it more than the other games. Dropsy is like a 3-star to me. Slayer's X also honestly kind of a 3-star to me because I don't like boomer shooters, but that's personally me. Hypnospace Outlaw is like 5 stars. It's like perfect to me. I wouldn't change anything about it. I really enjoyed it. It's like really some of the best indie game writing I've ever seen. So yeah, I would say Hypnospace Outlaw. And if you want some podcasts, I didn't listen to all of them, but I would say he's very earnest on the Humans of Gaming episode number 53 podcast. He seems like he's just chatting with a lot of people there because they're all his friends in the podcast. So he talks, and he's very earnest about how his Christianity helps him there. And there's also Pixelated Audio episode 108 with Chris Schlarp, where he talks about music and what that means to him while they played a Dropsy soundtrack in the background. And I think those two are the main recommendations for me. Anything from his podcast and talks that you want to recommend?
I didn't look at anything besides his website, like I said. I was really mostly interested in the close reading aspect and thinking about my own personal relationship to his work.
Yeah.
But his website is interesting. I would look at that website. It looks like a Hypnospace Outlaw website. It's perfect. Yeah. 90s look.
It does, yeah. Plus, he also has a really good blog post on there about talking about the very old games he made, which we didn't even talk about in this podcast. He made a bunch of very old games in Click and Play. Again, but this was back when he was like insulting Derek Yu on the internet. And they're all like, I'm not going to say very gory, but like obviously edgy in a 14-year-old way, in a way that I think relates to Slayer's X. And that Slayer's X is kind of him looking back at his edgy past and being like, what was I doing back then? So if you want to play those games also, some of them are on this page. Some of them aren't. Most of them are not, actually. He only has like 5 of his old games and he made like 40 of them. And also check out Control Me, which is his album. That's like his most experimental, I think, Christian album. It's just like a bunch of instruments laid on top of each other. There's electric ukulele. There's like prayers and chants and things like that. And it won multiple awards. Anything else?
That's it for me. Do you want to go on to our next auteur that we're going to be covering?
Yes. All right. Now, I recommended Jay Tolan, which you might have been able to tell from this episode. I talked a lot about him. Balls back in your court offer. What do you have for me?
Yeah, so you talked about someone that you were really passionate about and you had a lot of thoughts on. And I am going to suggest someone that I haven't really visited and I have not done any research. I've done a little bit of research, but I've not done enough research to know how to pronounce his name. I'm talking about Toshio Iwai. This is the creator of Electroplankton, which is what he's most known for, a little weird DS music game, and Otaki, which is a NES music game. I'm really interested in this because he's like an outsider artist. He seems to be mostly interested in music and art installations and just did a couple of games on the side. And this is from like a long time ago. This is an NES game, fucking 40 years ago. And a DS game in the early lifespan of that, like trying to see what this new technology could do. And I think that is really fascinating. I'm really interested in the idea of an outsider artist, and I want to check it out and see what's going on there.
Yeah, I'm also interested in the idea of an outside artist. I especially love outside artists who are meddling in mediums that they know little to nothing about, because usually it means that their idea of what a game is just like drastically pushes the medium in a whole new way that many people didn't even think of, or just like actively disrespects it, which is very funny to me. And I love that this guy, his two biggest main works is one made for the NES and one made for the DS. So he made one for the NES. He just kind of dipped. And then years later, he came back and he's like, can I make a DS game? And they're like, yeah, sure. Why not? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in this guy. I'll take a look at his, not just his work in video games. I think I'll try and take a look outside of his games. But yeah, I'm interested in Electroplankton and Otaki.
Both of these games are supposed to be really short, but if I had to recommend one, it would be Electroplankton because it's his most famous, and it's been sort of like canonized in Nintendo, being in Super Smash Bros., which is like crazy to me.
Yeah, which is insane because like if you held up a gun to like 98% of Nintendo fans and asked them what Electroplankton it is, they would tell you to shoot them. All right. Well, as always, I'm Galvin.
And I'm Author Function.
Thanks for listening.